Michael, Brother of Jerry, by Jack London. Chapter 1. But Michael never sailed out of Tulagi, Nigger Chaser, on board the schooner Eugenie. Once in 5 weeks, the steamer Macambo made Tulagi its port of call on the way from New Guinea and the Shortlands to Australia. And on the night of her belated arrival, Captain Keller forgot Michael on the beach. In itself, this was nothing, for at midnight, Captain Keller was back on the beach, himself climbing the high hill to the Commission's bungalow, while the boat's crew vainly rummaged the landscape and canoe houses. In fact, an hour earlier, as the Macumbo's anchor was heaving out, and while Captain Keller was descending the port gangplank, Michael was coming on board through a starboard porthole. This was because Michael was inexperienced in the world, because he was expecting to meet Jerry on board this boat, since the last he had seen of him was on a boat, and because he had made a friend. Dag Daughtry was a steward on the Macambo, who should have known better, and who would have known better and done better, had he not been fascinated by his own particular and peculiar reputation. By luck of birth, possessed of a genial but soft disposition, and a splendid constitution, his reputation was that for 20 years he had never missed his day's work, nor his 6 daily quarts of bottled beer, even, as he bragged, when in the German islands, where each bottle of beer carried 10 grains of quinine in solution as a specific against malaria. The captain of the Macambo, and before that the captains of the Moresby, the Messina, the Sir Edward Grace, and various others of the queerly named Burns Philp Company steamers had done the same, was used to pointing him out proudly to the passengers as a man-thing novel and unique in the annals of the sea. And at such times, Dag Daughtry, below on the forward deck, feigning unawareness as he went about his work, would steal side glances up at the bridge where the captain and his passengers stared down on him, and his breast would swell pridefully because he knew that the captain was saying, "See him? That's Dag Daughtry, the human tank. Never's been drunk or sober in 20 years, and has never missed his 6 quarts of beer per diem. You wouldn't think it to look at him, but I assure you it's so. I can't understand. Gets my admiration. Always does his time and a half, and his double time overtime. Why, a single glass of beer would give me heartburn and spoil my next good meal. But he flourishes on it. Look at him, look at him." And so, knowing his captain's speech, swollen with pride in his own prowess, Dag Daughtry would continue his shipwork with extra vigour and punish a 7th quart of the day, an advertisement of his remarkable constitution. It was a queer sort of fame, as queer as some men are, and Dag Daughtry found in it his justification of existence. Wherefore he devoted his energy and the soul of him to the maintenance of his reputation as a 6-quart man. That was why he made in odd moments of off-duty, turtle-shell combs and hair ornaments for profit, and was prettily crooked in such a matter as stealing another man's dog. Somebody had to pay for the 6 quarts, which, multiplied by 30, amounted to a tidy sum in the course of the month, and since that man was Dag Daughtry, he found it necessary to pass Michael inboard on the Macambo through a starboard porthole. On the beach, that night at Tulagi, vainly wondering what had become of the whaleboat, Michael had met the squat, thick, hair-grizzled ship's steward. The friendship between them was established almost instantly for Michael, from a mere puppy had matured into a merry dog. Far beyond Jerry was he a sociable good fellow, and this despite the fact that he had known very few white men. First there had been Mr. Hagin, Darby and Bob of Morangi. Next, Captain Keller, and Captain Keller's mate of the Eugenie. And finally, Harley Kennan, and the officers of the Ariel. Without exception, he had found them all different, and delightfully different, from the hordes of blacks he had been taught to despise and to lord it over. And Dag Daughtry had proved no exception from his first greeting of,
"Hello, you white man's dog. What are you doing here in nigger country?"
Michael had responded coyly, with an assumption of dignified aloofness that was given the lie by the eager tilt of his eyes and the good humour that shone in his eyes. Nothing of this was missed by Dag Daughtry, who knew a dog when he saw one, as he studied Michael in the light of the lanterns held by black boys where the whaleboats were landing cargo. Two estimates the steward quickly made of Michael. He was a likeable dog, genial-natured on the face of it, and he was a valuable dog. Because of those estimates, Dag Daughtry glanced about him quickly. No one was observing. For the moment, only blacks stood about, and their eyes were turned seaward, where the sounds of oars out of the darkness warned them to stand ready to receive the next cargo-laden boat. Off to the right, under another lantern, he could make out the residence commissioner's clerk and the Macambo's supercargo, heatedly discussing some error in the bill of lading. The steward flung another quick glance over Michael and made up his mind. He turned away casually and strolled along the beach out of the circle of lantern light. 100 yards away, he sat down in the sand and waited.
"Worth £20 if a penny," he muttered to himself. "If I couldn't get £10 for him, just like that, with a thank you, ma'am, I'm a sucker that didn't know a terrier from a greyhound. Sure, £10 in any pub on Sydney Beach."
And £10, metamorphosed into quart bottles of beer, reared an immense and radiant vision, very like a brewery, inside his head. A scurry of feet in the sand and low sniffings stiffened him to alertness. It was as he had hoped. The dog had liked him from the start and had followed him. For Dag Daughtry had a way with him, as Michael was quickly to learn. When the man's hand reached out and clutched to him, half by the jowl, half by the slack of the neck under the ear. There was no threat in that reach, nothing tentative nor timorous. It was hearty, all confident, and it produced confidence in Michael. It was roughness without hurt, assertion without threat, surety without seduction. To him, it was the most natural thing in the world, thus to be familiarly seized and shaken about by a total stranger, while a jovial voice muttered,
"That's right, dog. Stick around, and you'll wear diamonds, maybe."
Certainly, Michael had never met a man so immediately likeable. Dag Daughtry knew, instinctively to be sure, how to get on with dogs. By nature, there was no cruelty in him. He never exceeded in petting. He did not overbid for Michael's friendliness. He did bid, but in a manner that conveyed no sense of bidding. Scarcely had he given Michael that introductory jowl shake when he released him and apparently forgot all about him. He proceeded to light his pipe, using several matches as if the wind blew them out. But while they burned close up to his fingers, and while he made a simulation of prodigious puffing, his keen little blue eyes, under shaggy, grizzled brows, intently studied Michael. And Michael, ears cocked and eyes intent, gazed at the stranger who seemed never to have been a stranger at all. If anything, it was disappointment Michael experienced, in that his delightful two-legged god took no further notice of him. He even challenged him to closer acquaintance with an invitation to play,
with an abrupt movement, lifting his paws from the ground and striking them down, stretched out well before. His body bent down from the rump in such a curve that almost his chest touched the sand, his stump of a tail waving signals of good nature, while he uttered a sharp, inviting bark. And the man was uninterested, pulling solidly away at his pipe, in the darkness following upon the third match. Never was there a more consummate love-making, with all the base intent of betrayal, than this cavalier seduction of Michael by the elderly six-quart ship's steward. When Michael, not entirely unwitting of the snub of the man's lack of interest, stirred restlessly with a threat to depart, he had flung at him gruffly, "Stick around, dog, stick around!" Dag Daughtry chuckled to himself as Michael, advancing, sniffed his trouser legs long and earnestly, and the man took advantage of his nearness to study him some more, lighting his pipe and running over the dog's excellent lines. "Some dog, some points," he said aloud approvingly. Say, dog, you could pull down ribbons like a candy kid in any bench show anywheres. Only thing against you is that ear, and I could almost iron it out myself. A vet could do it." Carelessly, he dropped a hand to Michael's ear, and with tips of fingers, instinct with sensuous sympathy, began to manipulate the base of the ear, where its roots bedded in the tightness of skin stretch over the skull. And Michael liked it. Never had a man's hand been so intimate with his ear without hurting it. But these fingers were provocative only of physical pleasure, so keen that he twisted and writhed his whole body in acknowledgement. Next came a long, steady, upward pull of the ear, the ear slipping slowly through the fingers to the very tip of it, while it tingled exquisitely down to its root. Now to one ear, now to the other, this happened, and all the while the man uttered low words that Michael did not understand, but which he accepted as addressed to him.
"Head all right, good and flat," Dag Daughtry murmured,
first sliding his fingers over it, and then lighting a match.
No wrinkles, some jaw, good and punishing, not a shade too full in the cheek, or too empty.
He ran his fingers inside Michael's mouth, and noted the strength and evenness of the teeth, measured the breadth of the shoulders and depth of chest, and picked up a foot. In the light of another match, he examined all 4 feet.
"Black, all black, every nail of them," said Daughtry, "and as clean feet as ever a dog walked on. Straight-out toes, with a proper arch, and small, and not too small. Oh, I bet your daddy and your mother canted away with the ribbons in their day."
Michael was for growing restless at such searching examination, but Daughtry, in the midst of feeling out the lines and build of the thighs and hocks, paused, took Michael's tail in his magic fingers, exploring the muscles, among which it rooted, pressed, and prodding the adjacent spinal column from which it sprang, and twisting it about in a most daringly intimate way. And Michael was in an ecstasy, bracing his hindquarters to one side or the other against the caressing fingers. With open hands laid along his sides, and partly under him, the man suddenly lifted him from the ground. But before he could feel alarm, he was back on the ground again.
26 or 7. You're over 25 right now. I'll bet you on it. Shillings to halfpennies. You'll make 30 when you're full weight," Dag Daughtry told him. "But what of it? Lots of judges fancy the 30 mark, and you could always train off a few ounces. You're all dog and all correct conformation. You've got the racing build and the fighting weight, and there ain't no feathers on your legs. No, sir, Mr. Dog, your weight's to the good, and that ear can be ironed out by any respectable dog doctor. I bet there's 100 men in Sydney right now that would fork over 20 quid for the right of calling you his.
And then, just that Michael should not make the mistake of thinking he was being much made over, Daughtry leaned back, relighted his pipe, and apparently forgot his existence. Instead of bidding for goodwill, he was bent on making Michael do the bidding. And Michael did, bumping his flanks against Daughtry's knee, nudging his head against Daughtry's hand, in solicitation for more of the blissful ear-rubbing and tail-twisting. Daughtry caught him by the jowl instead, and slowly moved his head back and forth as he addressed him.
"What man's dog are you? Maybe you're a nigger's dog, and that ain't right. Maybe some nigger stole you, and that'd be awful. Think of the cruel fates that sometimes happens to dogs. It's a damn shame. No white man stands for a nigger's owning the likes of you, and here's one white man that ain't going to stand for it. The idea! A nigger owning you and not knowing how to train you. Of course a nigger stole you. If I laid eyes on him right now, I'd up and knock 7 bells and the St. Paul chimes out of him. Sure thing I would. Just show me to him, and out all, and see what I'd do to him. The idea of you taking orders from a nigger and fetching and carrying for him. No, sir, dog, you ain't going to do it any more. You're coming along of me, and I reckon I won't have to urge you.
Dag Daughtry stood up and turned carelessly along the beach. Michael looked after him, but did not follow. He was eager to, but had received no invitation. At last, Daughtry made a low kissing sound with his lips. So low was it that he scarcely heard it himself, and almost took it on faith, or on the testimony of his lips, rather than of his ears, that he had made it. No human being could have heard it across the distance to Michael. But Michael heard it, and sprang away after it, in a great, delighted rush.
File 2
Chapter 2 Dag Daughtry strolled along the beach, Michael at his heels or running circles of delight around him at every repetition of that strange, low-lip noise, and paused just outside the circle of lantern light where dusky forms laboured with landing cargo from the whaleboats, and where the Commissioner's clerk and the Macambo's supercargo still wrangled over the bill of lading. When Michael would have gone forward, the man withstrained him with the same inarticulate, almost inaudible kiss. For Daughtry did not care to be seen on such dog-stealing enterprises, and was planning how to get on board the steamer unobserved. He edged around the outside of the lantern shine, and went on along the beach to the native village. As he had foreseen, all the able-bodied men were down at the boat landing, working cargo. The grass houses seemed lifeless, but at last from one of them came a challenge in the querulous, high-pitched tones of age.
"What name?"
"Me walk about plenty too much,"
he replied in the Bechtemer English of the West South Pacific.
"Me belong a long steamer. Suppose you take me a long canoe, washy-washy, me give me fella boy 2 stick tobacco."
"Suppose me give me 10 stick, all right along me,"
came the reply.
"Me give 5 stick, the 6-quart steward bargained. "Suppose me you no like 5 stick, then you fella boy go to hell close up."
There was a silence.
"You like 5 stick?
Daughtry insisted of the dark interior.
"Me like 'em,"
the darkness answered, and through the darkness the body that owned the voice approached with such strange sounds that the steward lighted a match to see. A bleary-eyed ancient stood before him, balancing on a single crutch. His eyes were half filmed over by a growth of morbid membrane, and what was not yet covered shone red and irritated. His hair was mangy, standing out in isolated patches of wispy grey. His skin was scarred and wrinkled and mottled, and in colour was a purplish-blue surface with a grey coating that might have been painted there had it not indubitably grown there and been part and parcel of him. A blighted leper, was Daughtry's thought, as his quick eyes leapt from hands to feet in quest of missing toe and finger joints. But in those items the ancient was intact, although one leg ceased midway between knee and thigh.
"My word! What place stop that fella leg?"
quoth Daughtry, pointing to the space which the member would have occupied had it not been absent.
Big fella sharkfish. That fella leg stop 'em along him."
The ancient grinned, exposing a horrible aperture of toothlessness for a mouth.
"Me fella, me old fella buy too much,"
the one-legged Methuselah quavered.
"Long time, too much no smoking tobacco. Supposem you big fella, white master, give him one fella stick. Close up, me washy-washy you that fella steamer."
"Supposem me no give,"
the steward impatiently temporised. For reply, the old man half-turned, and on his crutch, swinging his stump of leg in the air, began sidling hippity-hop into the grass hut.
"All right," Daughtry cried hastily. "Me give 'em you smokin' quick, fella."
He dipped into a side-coat pocket for the mintage of the Solomons and stripped off a stick from the handful of pressed sticks. The old man was transfigured as he reached avidly for the stick and received it. He uttered little crooning noises, alternating with sharp cries akin to pain, half ecstatic, half petulant, as he drew a black clay pipe from a hole in his earlobe, and into the bowl of it, with trembling fingers, untwisted and crumbled the cheap leaf of spoiled Virginia crop. Pressing down the contents of the full bowl with his thumb, he suddenly plumped upon the ground, the crutch beside him, the one limb under him, so that he had the seeming of a legless torso. From a small bag of twisted coconut hanging from his neck, upon his withered and sunken chest, he drew out flint and steel and tinder, and even while the impatient steward was proffering him a box of matches, struck a spark, caught it